live moment by moment. We don't know what... We're looking at the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, and in looking there, we've been talking about this harlot woman and how it's an ecclesiastical system and how improbable as it may sound, it's an amalgamation of many divergent things. And I ran across, now get this straight, we've been opposing the idea that that harlot woman is the Pope. It's Roman Catholicism. We believe that's part of it, but not all of it. And we're not saying now that this is a fulfilling of prophecy. It is not. No prophecy is being fulfilled today. The next prophecy will be the rapture of the church. But just to show you how easily these things could happen, Saturday's paper was very enlightening. Now, starting today and for 18 days up in Vancouver on the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, British Columbia, there's going to be 4,000 people representing the World Council of Churches. Now, the World Council of Churches is an amalgamation of a lot of speckled birds in religion. Liberals, they don't believe in the deity of Christ. They don't believe in the shed blood of Christ for sins. They don't believe that you're saved by God's work for you. See, they don't believe any of what we believe. They're a bunch of speckled birds, liberals to the nth degree. And they're meeting there, but look at who's meeting with them. I want to read just two paragraphs, and then we want to talk about this new leader. It's amazing who they've chosen for a new leader, and the sap would accept it. And I mean that. All right, now it says the 18-day meeting opens Sunday on the campus of the University of British Columbia with worship services in the big seaside tent, followed by a celebration of music, dance, and pageantry. That's good worship service. About 4,000 people from 100 countries are expected. 900 of them are official voting delegates from Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, National Catholic, Anglican, Pentecostal, and independent denominations. They include most of the world's Christians outside of the Roman Catholic or Roman Catholicism, the biggest of the churches. However, though the Roman Church doesn't belong to this, look what it says. The Roman Church is also active in some of the council work and has a large delegation on hand. Members of a joint Roman Catholic World Council Working Group say they share in the one ecumenical movement and are guided by an increasing common understanding of the goals of the invisible church unity. See what it's saying? They're right ready. When the harlot woman says, join, they'll join. You see? All right, now who's the leader of this hodgepodge speckled bird group? Well, it's a conservative, they say. Now, I want to read this. This shows you the Reformed Church. Now, we've talked about Reformed Church. I don't believe they're saved. They don't know the gospel, but they're supposed to be conservative. And the new leader of this outfit is a fellow who is, let me read it. This guy is supposed to be a conservative. A tall Midwesterner of old-line conservative Christian heritage is moving into the top post of the often-attacked World Council of Churches, convinced the blast against it are misinformation and propaganda. Now, let me say, there is a slight misunderstanding. Your 60 Minutes, your Reader's Digest, have accused the National Council of being Marxist. Now, they should have modified that. See, Marx was anti-religion. What these people want is communism that's religious. They want the same thing of communism. They want to redistribute the wealth, redistribute property. Give you your $518. That's all you get. They took all the wealth of the United States and distributed it between everybody on the world. $518. Would you want it? No. All right. Now, they're being accused of being Marxist. The persons accusing them don't realize what they want, a religious Marxism, not an atheistic Marxism. Then it's right. They are Marxist. You see? Now, he's saying they're not. Now, this guy, here's what it says he is. He's a conservative. See? Here's what he is. This fellow who for the last 6 years has been the chief administrator of the Reformed Church in America, of Dutch origins. The denomination was the longest unbroken ministry in this country, dates back to 1624, and Brouwers cherishes its conservative tradition. Conservative is a good word to me in the sense of conservating values and principles, And so he's conservative. Well, why did he join the most left-wing, most out-in-the-left-field group in the world? Well, because he has no discernment, because he's not saved, because he's just a church member. That's all. Now let me read you another thing if you want to see the Marxism, the Christian Marxism. Are you thankful when God gives you a paycheck? You should be. Are you thankful that we live in a country that has many blessings? I am, every day. And that's the Christian attitude. But let me read this guy's attitude. He wants to go to this national or the World Council meeting and meet some of these Christians from El Salvador and Nicaragua and other places so he can do this. I want to convey to Christians in the Southern Hemisphere what it means to be a part of a Christianity that feels very guilty because we're aware of our affluence and our privileges. I don't feel one tinge of guilt. That's Marxism with a quote-unquote Christian flavor. He's guilty because our country is so well-to-do. Well, I thank God it is. If you don't like it, I'll take up a collection to help move you where you'd be happy. This country's so bad, then why don't they go where they think it's so good and not try to change this country? You see? No, they want to whop us, pull us down to the level. Now this is what he says. You see, and then what they do, they misread Acts 5, where people, and that, because they didn't have any information, they lived in common, had things in common, and they call that communism. It wasn't communism at all. It failed. It wasn't ordered of God. It failed. They didn't have any instruction. And then they go back to the Beatitudes, and they misread those. Now it says, I want to convey to Christians in the Southern Hemisphere what it means to be part of a Christianity that feels very guilty because we are aware of our affluence and our privileges. If Jesus Christ is the life of the world, which is the conference theme, then there's got to be some good news for us too. All right, their good news is they want to redistribute the wealth of the world, and that means yours, with somebody in the third world, because they don't want a third world. They want it all a one world. And if that isn't Marxism, then I'm a monkey's uncle. And I can't climb worth a toodly-doo. All right? And so I'm not a monkey's uncle. Now let's turn to the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation then. And we've been looking at this harlot woman. This is forming the basis. It'll be very simple when opposition. Now opposition comes from believers. I oppose the National Council. I oppose the World Council. I oppose everything they stand for and what they sit down on, too. When opposition is gone at the rapture, it'll be very simple for this group with no opposition. I didn't read the other. There's opposing groups meeting up there in Vancouver, about five of them opposing the World Council. I didn't read that. But there are. And when opposition is gone, then it'll be very simple for all this gelatin stuff to flow together. Get together. But it isn't Roman Catholicism. It'll include it. It'll include it. And I'm just reading a book here. He says it's the Vatican. No, it isn't the Vatican. Now we want to look at the 9th verse of the 17th chapter because this book, and it's one of the best I've read on this Revived Roman Empire by L. Sayles Harrison, they confuse a lot of things. You see, this woman is riding a beast. The beast has the seven heads. So it's the woman, as she's related to this beast, gets her geographical location. She doesn't give a geographical location to the beast because the beast has the seven heads. She's riding the beast, and the beast's seven heads refer to two things. First, the seven heads on the beast refer to seven mountains, where the woman is sitting, but she's sitting on the beast. So she gets her geographical location from the beast. You see? He's the one that's located in the city of Rome. And the city of Rome and the Vatican are two different states, two different countries, if you want. Oh, they're all in Italy. But it's an independent country, the Vatican. Have their own mailbox, their own security guards, their own army, their own taxes. They're an independent country. All right? And so the woman gets her geographic. Now, the woman also represents a city. If you look down at the 18th verse, so if the woman is riding the beast and gets her geographical location from the beast, and yet she's a city. You see? This is how we get it's the city of Rome. Do you see that? And it's not the Vatican, and it's not Roman Catholicism. All right? Now, I'm not for Roman Catholicism. I'm just for being fair. That's all. And so it says, here's the mind which has wisdom, the seven heads, but the seven heads belong to the beast, and the woman's riding the beast. The seven heads are seven mountains. So obviously that's giving you a geographic location, some place to locate in reference to some specific geographic consequences. Seven mountains. And as we said, in history books, anything that you read, Rome is the city of seven hills or mountains. You know that mountains are relative. When we were back east, your Adirondacks and all, they call them mountains. Well, they make good foothills out here. But they call them mountains. You see? So the word mountain is very relative. And so you have this city of seven mountains or seven hills, Rome. Now you'll notice in the 10th verse, these seven heads also represent something else. And we've gone over this. And you should change the first two words of the 10th verse, also, instead of and. The word that's translated and can be translated three ways, even, also, or and. And it's determined by the context. This is an additional truth that's not continuing the thought of the prior truth. So it's not and, it's not a continuative conjunction. It's telling you another truth about these seven heads. You see, also they, instead of there, they are seven kings. So the seven heads are mountains, and they're also kings. All right? And there's no doubt about it in the original. It's simply the pronominal suffix on the verb. And they are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, and the other is yet to come. And when he has come, he must continue for a short space. And we told you that that went right back to Daniel, and we're going to Daniel 2 as soon as we get down here at the 12th verse and look at these 10 kings, because we want to know where they come from. We want to know their background. We want to know why they appear on the scene. And you'll notice he says, and the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. Now you see, that's an amazing thing, isn't it? This beast had seven heads, and those seven heads are seven kings. But differently, then he has 10 horns, and the 10 horns are 10 kings. But they're different, you see. The one refers to some that have been, and some that are future. And this is talking about 10 horns, which are 10 kings. So you have the heads and the horns representing the same thing, except the same thing in that they're kings, not the same kings, except that the heads represent also mountains. All right, now these 10 kings, who are they? Where do they rule? Well, you'll notice these 10 horns, they come on the scene before they have any rule, before they have any kingdom, because it says the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet. But they shall receive power as kings for a short time with the beast. Then it's going to tell you how their power will be with the beast. They're going to get the kingdom. They're going to get power. And then they're going to have one mind, because God's going to give them that mind. And here you have the sovereignty of God. And here you have a good sermon for Pastor Spurbeck. This would be a case where the bulimai, the determinative will of God, and the desirous will meet. And these kings do it. There's no way out. They do it. Because there's no way out. Aren't you glad God didn't do that to you? You have a choice. You can fulfill God's desirous will, or you can refute and frustrate God's desirous will. If God determined it, you'd do it, whether you liked it or not. And notice this is what it says here about these 10 kings, that God will put it into their mind, and they have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. But notice down in the 17th verse, you see, you have the outward appearance, the 13th verse. If you were looking at them, you'd say, hey, these guys, they're all thinking the same thing. They're all going to do the same thing. Why did they say think the same thing? Why did they do the same thing? Look down at the 17th verse. For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom to the beast. That's why they did it. There you have the determinative will of God and his desirous will coming right together. And these guys have no choice. They're not like you. These guys are robots, if you want to say it. They have no choice. They can't get out of it. They can't change it. They can't say no to it. They do it. You see? Now you have many places in Scripture where this is true. If you want to look back in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, you're going to see a perfect illustration of this. A man's going to think a thought. He's going to think he's pretty smart. But he doesn't know that God has a hook in his jaw pulling him. And he can't get out of it. Let's just look at it as an example. It's not the same time. It's not the same condition. It's not the same individuals involved. But you have the same principle. You have God ordering it, God determining it, God desiring it, and it can't change. Now, you see, it's a good thing in 1 Timothy 2:5, it doesn't say God determined all men to be saved, or they'd all be saved. It just says God desires that. But he never determined it, or all would be saved. And that's because in the decree it already determined all would fall and be doomed. And then he chose some out. That's what elect or choosing means. Now in Ezekiel 38, look very, very carefully, and you'll see the two things that happen. Notice the 10th verse. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall come to pass that at the same time shall things come into your mind, and you shall think an evil thought, and you shall say, I will go up, I will do this, I will do that. See, this guy's thinking something. He said, boy, I planned this. I planned this. Why did he plan it? Let's look back, if you will, to the 4th verse. The 4th verse. And I will turn you back and put a hook in your jaw, and I will bring you forth. You see, he couldn't do it otherwise. Those thoughts came into his mind because they were put there. And God determined he was going to go down. And God put a hook in his jaw and he couldn't get loose. And he went down. And there you have what we call the sovereignty of God. And the responsibility of man, or putting it in other terms, the determinative will of God as it meets his desirous will. And they coincide. And there's no way out. Now, God doesn't do that to Christians. Or you would be robots and you would get no credit. When you have victory, you'd have no blessing. When you have victory. But God does do it. Now, these 10 kings are the same as those Daniel has spoken of 3 different times. And we want to look back at Daniel 2 to see how these kings will be related geographically, what part of the world they'll be ruling over, and how they relate to prophecy. So we look back to Daniel 2, and then if we have time, we'll look at Daniel 7, which covers the same ground from a different point of view with added details on those 10 kings. Now in Daniel 2, you have an unusual thing. You had a king that dreamed a dream, then he forgot the dream, and he asked the impossible of his magicians and his sorcerers. He asked them not only to tell him the dream he dreamed, which he'd forgotten, but then interpret the dream which he'd forgotten. How'd you like an assignment like that? Especially if told when you failed that you lose the most important property you have, your head. Well, that was the assignment, you see. And Daniel rises up and says, there's a God in heaven, and he'll reveal it. And Daniel asks mercy for the henchmen, and that they not be killed for failing the assignment. Now Daniel is going to tell the dream. Now this dream, you see, was given to a heathen king. It wasn't given to Daniel. It was given to a heathen king. Now when it's given to Daniel, it's going to take on a little different thing. Now heathen, unsaved people, they think of power, they think of politics, they think of it in terms of man, and they deify man. All of your NAE propaganda now is based on the false assumption that man is an evolutionary creature and that eventually he's going to come to perfection by his own effort. And if they have any religious flavor, they think that that same man has a little spark of divinity in him somehow. You see? And that's why they're teaching the things they do. And you should read some of the latest expose of what the NAE is doing and telling schools to teach. And it's all based on that atheistic concept that man is deity. He's his own God. He's the captain of his fate. If you think that, you're in for a sad awakening. A sad awakening. You can't even sometimes determine God's will for yourself. You see? You're in for a sad awakening. But that's based on that concept. Now, men do that. Hitler, Stalin, they thought of themselves as supreme. Kings, if you read about it, they thought of the divine rights of the kings. So how would you picture, if you're dreaming about empires, how you picture it in men's terms? And that's just exactly what Nebuchadnezzar did. He saw a huge statue of a man. This is a strange statue. It had different metals making it up. It had a head of gold. You'd think if it's going to have a head of gold, why not make the whole thing gold? No, not this statue. It had a head of gold, but the arms and the chest part here with the chest muscles was silver. That's a strange combination. And then down here for the stomach part, down to the hips, you had bronze. Then you had the legs, from the hip joints down the legs, you had iron. Then you got down to the feet, and the feet and the toes were iron mixed with burnt clay. Now, burnt clay is brittle. Clay itself is mushy, you know. Your kids play with it, sticks to stuff, throw it on the wall. The reason it's talked about here, it's brittle clay, it's burnt clay, clay that has been baked. And so it's brittle. Hit it with a hammer, it goes to pieces like fiberglass. Your insurance on your Corvettes is so high, you know. One smack going. Right? Brittle! Now that's a strange mixture. You mix brittle clay, baked clay, with iron. And that's the feat. Now, what did this all mean? Well, we're going to see as we look at it, that each part represented a king and a kingdom, a world Gentile power. And by a world power, we mean a time in history where there's one nation so far superior to everything else that it's a one world power. Now, we don't live in a world like that. We live in a world where there's a balance of power. Russia, China, the United States, and Britain and France. And we're not any bigger than all of them. And we're not bigger than Russia. There's a balance of power. You see? And so we're talking about world dominion by a Gentile world power. And you can check this in your history books. Now you'll notice what he tells us here. But before we look at this, I want you to look at a verse over in these two verses in the 7th chapter of Daniel so that you'll see the word beast, king, and kingdom are used interchangeably. And that'll help us when we get to the beasts. So look at the 7th chapter of Daniel. So when it says to Nebuchadnezzar, you are this, he's the king, and that means also his kingdom, you see. And we don't live in those days when you used to say a king did something, his whole kingdom did it. But look, two verses in the 7th chapter, and you'll see that the three words are used interchangeably, and it'll help us when we get to the 7th chapter and look at these beasts. If you look at the 17th verse of the 7th chapter, it says, these great beasts, which are four kings. Do you see that? So beasts and kings can be used interchangeably. We'll tell you why when we get to the 7th chapter. Because God looks at human government as a vicious thing that will do anything to survive. And you can see that right now, starting for our presidential election. You've got these kooky kooks running around wanting to be president, and they'll go to anybody under the sun and promise something. They're going to the women, the Now group, and to the Hispanics, and to the colored people, and to everybody under the sun to get votes. And then they get in, they won't do any better than anybody else, because they can't. How can you do something when Congress says no? Huh? All right? And so they'll do anything to survive. So God looks at human government as bestial. Self-survival. Now look at here, king and beast are the same. Now look over, if you will, at the 23rd verse. And you'll see that king and kingdom are the same. You see, these great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But over in the 23rd verse, he's talking about that fourth king or fourth beast, and he says, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom. So don't be upset if we use the word kingdom and king interchangeably. A king is his kingdom. Louis XIV said, I am France. And he meant it. He meant it. You see, a king and kingdom are the same. Otherwise, you don't have a king, you have a figurehead. That's what Britain is. Britain has a figurehead. They vote every year a little money to support their king and queen. And he's no more of a king than I am. All right? So you have this. Now then, keeping that in mind, look, if you will, you've got the same interchange in this interpretation. Now it's interesting, we don't have to give you the interpretation, it's right here in Daniel 2. Each part of this man image represented a different king or a different kingdom or two kings and their kingdom. You see? Now let's look at it. Starting with the 36th verse. This is the dream. He told the dream. And this is the dream. And the dream is told up in the starting with the 31st verse. Now he's going to tell the interpretation. This is a dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. You, O king, now this is Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, which in its turn was the one world Gentile empire. There was nothing comparable to it. Look at your history book, and history is centered around the Babylonian Empire. It'll give you a big picture of it, and everything else is nothing. I meant to bring in some of our maps here and use them, but we don't have any that are very clear and show you. All right, on the overhead. So he says, you, Nebuchadnezzar, you are king of kings, for the God of heaven has given thee a kingdom and power and strength and glory, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thy hand and hath made thee ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. Now you notice that head, that part of that figure, represented a king and a kingdom. So there's five parts that are going to represent king and kingdom. You have a head of gold. You have shoulders and chest muscles of silver. And that's the one to follow. Now notice, these kingdoms follow in succession, one after the other. He's not going to name the other kingdoms, but we will get them named in the book of Daniel, and you can get them out of history. What kingdom followed the Babylonian kingdom? The fifth chapter of Daniel tells you. It says the Medo-Persians conquered Babylon. And it's a perfect representation. Notice, if I were to represent the Medes and the Persians by this part of the body, my right arm is stronger than my left. The Medes were stronger than the Persians. Yet they too made up that kingdom. You see? The Medo-Persian Empire. And you'll notice that's what he says. After thee, in other words, the next part of the image, the silver part of the image, shall arise another kingdom inferior to you. Now, if you look over in the 8th chapter of Daniel, it tells you what kingdom that is. Look at what it was in the 20th verse, the Median and Persian kingdom. That was the kingdom that followed the Babylonian kingdom. They conquered Babylon. And in the 5th chapter of Daniel, it gives you the historical event of it. You see, the Medo-Persian. And it's a perfect illustration. Two arms are never the same in strength. Even these weightlifters and the bodybuilders, one is stronger than the other. Medes were stronger than the Persians. That's why they call it Medo-Persian instead of Persian Medo. Perfect illustration of a kingdom made up of two things, but one stronger than the other. Now, what kingdom followed that? Then there a third kingdom of brass, which will bear rule over all the land, over all the earth. Thee then know an earth. They're not talking about America and Alaska. Thee then know an earth. Who is that? Well, if you look at a history book, or better yet, if you look at the 8th chapter of Daniel, the thing that followed the Medo-Persian kingdom and followed Nebuchadnezzar was